hand than from any other. Therefore, sir, I accept your offer gratefully, and with many sincere acknowledgments for past favours. And I hope, sir, said Mrs. Sparsit, concluding in an impressively compassionate manner, I fondly hope that Miss Gradgrind may be all you desire and deserve. Nothing moved Mrs. Sparsit from that position any more. It was in vain for Bounderby to bluster or assert himself in any of his explosive ways. Mrs. Sparsit was resolved to have compassion on him as a victim. She was polite, obliging, cheerful, hopeful. But the more polite, the more obliging, the more cheerful, the more hopeful, the more exemplary altogether she, the forlorner sacrifice and victim, he. She had that tenderness for his melancholy fate that his great red countenance used to break out into cold perspirations when she looked at him. Meanwhile, the marriage was appointed to be solemnized in 8 weeks' time, and Mr. Bounderby went every evening to Stone Lodge as an accepted wooer. Love was made on these occasions in the form of bracelets, and on all occasions during the period of betrothal took a manufacturing aspect. Dresses were made, jewellery was made, cakes and gloves were made, settlements were made, and an extensive assortment of facts did appropriate honour to the contract. The business was all fact, from first to last. The hours did not go through any of those rosy performances which foolish poets have ascribed to them at such times. Neither did the clocks go any faster or any slower than at other seasons. The deadly statistical recorder in the Gradgrind Observatory knocked every second on the head as it was born, and buried it with his accustomed regularity. So the day came, as all other days come to people who will only stick to reason, and when it came, there were married in the Church of the Florid Wooden Legs, that popular order of architecture, Josiah Bounderby, Esquire of Coketown, to Louisa, eldest daughter of Thomas Gradgrind, Esquire, of Stone Lodge, MP for that borough. And when they were united in holy matrimony, they went home to breakfast at Stone Lodge aforesaid. There was an improving party assembled on the auspicious occasion, who knew what everything they had to eat and drink was made of, and how it was imported or exported, and in what quantities and in what bottoms, whether native or foreign, and all about it. The bridesmaids, down to little Jane Gradgrind, were, in an intellectual point of view, fit helpmates for the calculating boy, and there was no nonsense about any of the company. After breakfast, the bridegroom addressed them in the following terms. "Ladies and gentlemen, I am Josiah Bounderby of Coketown. Since you have done my wife and myself the honour of drinking our healths and happiness, I suppose I must acknowledge the same. Though, as you all know me, and know what I am, and what my extraction was, you won't expect a speech from a man who, when he sees a post, says that's a post, and when he sees a pump, says that's a pump, and is not to be got to call a post a pump or a pump a post, or either of them a toothpick. If you want a speech this morning, my friend and father-in-law, Tom Gradgrind, is a member of Parliament, and you know where to get it. I am not your man. However, if I feel a little independent when I look around this table today, and reflect how little I thought of marrying Tom Gradgrind's daughter when I was a ragged street boy who never washed his face unless it was at a pump, and that not oftener than once a fortnight, I hope I may be excused. So, I hope you like my feeling independent. If you don't, I can't help it. I do feel independent. Now, I have mentioned, and you have mentioned, that I am this day married to Tom Gradgrind's daughter. I am very glad to be so. It has long been my wish to be so. I have watched her bringing up, and I believe she is worthy of me. At the same time, not to deceive you, I believe I am worthy of her. So I thank you on both our parts for the goodwill you have shown towards us, and the best wish I can give the unmarried part of the present company is this. I hope every bachelor may find as good a wife as I have found, and I hope every spinster may find as good a husband as my wife has found. Shortly after which oration, As they were going on a nuptial trip to Lyon, in order that Mr. Bounderby might take the opportunity of seeing how the hands got on in those parts, and whether they too required to be fed with gold spoons, the happy pair departed for the railroad. The bride, in passing downstairs dressed for her journey, found Tom waiting for her, flushed either with his feelings or the vinous part of the breakfast. "What a game girl you are to be such a first-rate sister, Lou," whispered Tom. She clung to him as she should have clung to some far better nature that day, and was a little shaken in her reserved composure for the first time. "Old Bounderby's quite ready," said Tom. "Time's up. Goodbye. I shall be on the lookout for you when you come back. I say, my dear Lou, ain't it uncommonly jolly now?" Book the Second. Reaping. Chapter 1. Effects in the Bank. A sunny midsummer day. There was such a thing sometimes, even in Coketown. Seen from a distance in such weather, Coketown lay shrouded in a haze of its own, which appeared impervious to the sun's rays. You only knew the town was there because you knew there could have been no such sulky blotch upon the prospect without a town. A blur of soot and smoke, now confusedly tending this way, now that way, now aspiring to the vault of heaven, now murkily creeping along the earth as the wind rose and fell or changed its quarter. A dense, formless jumble with sheets of cross light in it that showed nothing but masses of darkness. Coketown in the distance was suggestive of itself, though not a brick of it could be seen. The wonder was it was there at all. It had been ruined so often that it was amazing how it had borne so many shocks. Surely there never was such fragile chinaware as that of which the millers of Coketown were made. Handle them never so lightly, and they fell to pieces with such ease that you might suspect them of having been floored before. They were ruined when they were required to send labouring children to school. They were ruined when inspectors were appointed to look into their works. They were ruined when such inspectors considered it doubtful whether they were quite justified in chopping people up with their machinery. They were utterly undone when it was hinted that perhaps they need not always make quite so much smoke. Besides Mr. Bounderby's gold spoon, which was generally received in Coketown, another prevalent fiction was very popular there. It took the form of a threat. Whenever a Coketowner felt that he was ill-used, that is to say, whenever he was not left entirely alone, and it was proposed to hold him accountable for the consequences of any of his acts, he was sure to come out with the awful menace that he would sooner pitch his property into the Atlantic. This had terrified the Home Secretary within an inch of his life on several occasions. However, the Coketowners were so patriotic, after all, that they never had pitched their property into the Atlantic yet, but, on the contrary, had been kind enough to take mighty good care of it. So, there it was, in the haze yonder, and it increased and multiplied. The streets were hot and dusty on the summer day, and the sun was so bright that it even shone through the heavy vapour drooping over Coketown and could not be looked at steadily. Stokers emerged from low underground doorways into factory yards and sat on steps and posts and palings, wiping their swarthy visages and contemplating coals. The whole town seemed to be frying in oil. There was a stifling smell of hot oil everywhere. The steam engines shone with it, the dresses of the hands were soiled with it. The mills throughout their many stories oozed and trickled it. The atmosphere of those fairy palaces was like the breath of the simoom, and their inhabitants, wasting with heat, toiled languidly in the desert. But no temperature made the melancholy mad elephants more mad or more sane. Their wearisome heads went up and down at the same rate in hot weather and cold, wet weather and dry, fair weather and foul. The measured motion of their shadows on the walls was the substitute Coketown had to show for the shadows of rustling woods, while for the summer hum of insects it could offer all the year round, from the dawn of Monday to the night of Saturday, the whir of shafts and wheels. Drowsily they whirred all through this sunny day, making the passenger more sleepy and more hot as he passed the humming walls of the mills. Sun blinds and sprinklings of water a little cooled the main streets and the shops, but the mills and the courts and alleys baked at a fierce heat. Down upon the river, that was black and thick with dye, some Coketown boys who were at large, a rare sight there, rowed a crazy boat which made a spumous track upon the water as it jogged along, while every dip of an oar stirred up vile smells. But the sun itself, however beneficent generally, was less kind to Coketown than hard frost, and rarely looked intently into any of its closer regions without engendering more death than life. So does the eye of heaven itself become an evil eye, when incapable or sordid hands are interposed between it and the things it looks upon to bless. Mrs. Sparsit sat in her afternoon apartment at the bank, on the shadier side of the frying street. Office hours were over, and at that period of the day, in warm weather, she usually embellished with her genteel presence a managerial boardroom over the public office. Her own private sitting room was a story higher, at the window of which post of observation she was ready every morning to greet Mr. Bounderby as he came across the road, with the sympathizing recognition appropriate to a victim. He had been married now a year, and Mrs. Sparsit had never released him from her determined pity a moment. The bank offered no violence to the wholesome monotony of the town. It was another red brick house with black outside shutters, green inside blinds, a black street door up two white steps, a brazen door plate, and a brazen door handle full stop. It was a size larger than Mr. Bounderby's house, as other houses were from a size to half a dozen sizes smaller. In all other particulars, it was strictly according to pattern. Mrs. Sparsit was conscious that by coming in the evening tide among the desks and writing implements, she shed a feminine, not to say also aristocratic, grace upon the office. Seated with her needlework or netting apparatus at the window, she had a self-laudatory sense of correcting by her ladylike deportment the rude business aspect of the place. With this impression of her interesting character upon her, Mrs. Sparsit considered herself in some sort the bank fairy. The townspeople, who in their passing and repassing saw her there, regarded her as the bank dragon, keeping watch over the treasures of the mine. What those treasures were, Mrs. Sparsit knew as little as they did. Gold and silver coin, precious paper, secrets that if divulged would bring vague destruction upon vague persons, generally, however, people whom she disliked, were the chief items in her ideal catalogue thereof. For the rest, she knew that after office hours she reigned supreme over all the office furniture, and over a locked-up iron room with three locks, against the door of which strong chamber the light porter laid his head every night on a truckle bed that disappeared at cockcrow. Further, she was lady paramount over certain vaults in the basement, sharply spiked off from communication with the predatory world, and over the relics of the current day's work consisting of blots of ink, worn-out pens, fragments of wafers, and scraps of paper torn so small that nothing interesting could ever be deciphered on them when Mrs. Sparsit tried. Lastly, she was guardian over a little armory of cutlasses and carbines, arrayed in vengeful order above one of the official chimney-pieces, and over that respectable tradition never to be separated from a place of business claiming to be wealthy, a row of fire-buckets. Vessels calculated to be of no physical utility on any occasion, but observed to exercise a fine moral influence, almost equal to bullion, on most beholders. A deaf serving woman and the light porter completed Mrs. Sparsit's empire. The deaf serving woman was rumoured to be wealthy, and a saying had for years gone about among the lower orders of Coketown that she would be murdered some night, when the bank was shut, for the sake of her money. It was generally considered, indeed, that she had been due some time, and ought to have fallen long ago, but she had kept her life, and her situation, with an ill-conditioned tenacity that occasioned much offence and disappointment. Mrs. Sparsit's tea was just set for her on a pert little table with its tripod of legs in an attitude, which she insinuated after office hours into the company of the stern, leathern-topped, long board table that bestrode the middle of the room. The light porter placed the tea tray on it, knuckling his forehead as a form of homage. "Thank you, Bitzer," said Mrs. Sparsit.
"Thank you, ma'am,"
returned the light porter. He was a very light porter indeed, as light as in the days when he blinkingly defined a horse for girl number 20.
"All is shut up, Bitzer," said Mrs. Sparsit.
"All is shut up, ma'am."
"And what," said Mrs. Sparsit, pouring out her tea, "is the news of the day? Anything?"
"Well, ma'am, I can't say that I've heard anything particular. Our people are a bad lot, ma'am, but that is no news, unfortunately."
"What are the restless wretches doing now?"
asked Mrs. Sparsit.
"Merely going on in the old way, ma'am, uniting and leaguing and engaging to stand by one another."
"It is much to be regretted,"
said Mrs. Sparsit, making her nose more Roman and her eyebrows more Coriolanian in the strength of her severity,
"that the United Masters allow of any such class combinations."
"Yes, ma'am," said Bitzer.
"Being united themselves, they ought one and all to set their faces against employing any man who is united with any other man,"
said Mrs. Sparsit.
"They have done that, ma'am," returned Bitzer, "but it rather fell through, ma'am."
"I do not pretend to understand these things," said Mrs. Sparsit with dignity. "My lot having been signally cast in a widely different sphere, and Mr. Sparsit, as a Powler, being also quite out of the pale of any such dissensions, I only know that these people must be conquered, and that it's high time it was done, once and for all."
"Yes, ma'am," returned Bitzer, with a demonstration of great respect for Mrs. Sparsit's oracular authority. "You couldn't put it clearer, I am sure, ma'am."
As this was his usual hour for having a little confidential chat with Mrs. Sparsit, and as he had already caught her eye and seen that she was going to ask him something, he made a pretense of arranging the rulers, inkstands, and so forth, while that lady went on with her tea, glancing through the open window down into the street.
"Has it been a busy day, Bitzer?"
asked Mrs. Sparsit.
"Not a very busy day, my lady. About an average day."
He now and then slided into "my lady" instead of "ma'am," as an involuntary acknowledgement of Mrs. Sparsit's personal dignity and claims to reverence.
"The clerks," said Mrs. Sparsit, carefully brushing an imperceptible crumb of bread and butter from her left-hand mitten, "are trustworthy, punctual, and industrious, of course?"
"Yes, ma'am. Pretty fair, ma'am, with the usual exception."
He held the respectable office of general spy and informer in the establishment, for which volunteer service he received a present at Christmas over and above his weekly wage. He had grown into an extremely clear-headed, cautious, prudent young man, who was safe to rise in the world. His mind was so exactly regulated that he had no affections or passions. All his proceedings were the result of the nicest and coldest calculation. And it was not without cause that Mrs. Sparsit habitually observed of him that he was a young man of the steadiest principle she had ever known. Having satisfied himself on his father's death that his mother had a right of settlement in Coketown, this excellent young economist had asserted that right for her with such a steadfast adherence to the principle of the case that she had been shut up in the workhouse ever since. It must be admitted that he allowed her half a pound of tea a year, which was weak in him. First, because all gifts have an inevitable tendency to pauperize the recipient, and secondly, because his only reasonable transaction in that commodity would have been to buy it for as little as he could possibly give, and sell it for as much as he could possibly get, it having been clearly ascertained by philosophers that in this is comprised the whole duty of man, not a part of man's duty, but the whole.
"Pretty fair, ma'am, with the usual exception, ma'am," repeated Bitzer.
"Ah,"
said Mrs. Sparsit, shaking her head over her teacup and taking a long gulp.
"Mr. Thomas, ma'am. I doubt Mr. Thomas very much, ma'am. I don't like his ways at all."
"Bitzer," said Mrs. Sparsit, in a very impressive manner, "do you recollect my having said anything to you respecting names?" I beg your pardon, ma'am. It's quite true that you did object to names being used, and they're always best avoided.
Please to remember that I have a charge here, said Mrs. Sparsit with her air of state. I hold a trust here, Bitzer, under Mr. Bounderby. However improbable both Mr. Bounderby and myself might have deemed it years ago that he would ever become my patron, making me an annual compliment, I cannot but regard him in that light. From Mr. Bounderby I have received every acknowledgement of my social station and every recognition of my family descent that I could possibly expect. More, far more. Therefore, to my patron I will be scrupulously true. And I do not consider, I will not consider, I cannot consider, said Mrs. Sparsit, with a most extensive stock on hand of honour and morality, that I should be scrupulously true if I allowed names to be mentioned under this roof that are unfortunately, most unfortunately, no doubt of that, connected with his.
Bitzer knuckled his forehead again, and again begged pardon.
No, Bitzer, continued Mrs. Sparsit, say an individual, and I will hear you. Say Mr. Thomas, and you must excuse me.
With the usual exception, ma'am, said Bitzer, trying back, of an individual.
Ah.
Mrs. Sparsit repeated the ejaculation, the shake of the head over her teacup, and the long gulp, as taking up the conversation again at the point where it had been interrupted.
An individual, ma'am, said Bitzer, has never been what he ought to have been since he first came into the place. He is a dissipated, extravagant idler. He's not worth his salt, ma'am. He wouldn't get it, either, if he hadn't a friend and relation at court, ma'am.
Ah, said Mrs. Sparsit, with another melancholy shake of her head.
I only hope, ma'am, pursued Bitzer, that his friend and relation may not supply him with the means of carrying on. Otherwise, ma'am, we know out of whose pocket that money comes.
Ah, sighed Mrs. Sparsit again, with another melancholy shake of her head.
He is to be pitied, ma'am. The last party I have alluded to is to be pitied, ma'am, said Bitzer.
Yes, Bitzer, said Mrs. Sparsit. I have always pitied the delusion, always.
As to an individual, ma'am, said Bitzer,
dropping his voice and drawing nearer.
He is as improvident as any of the people in this town. And you know what their improvidence is, ma'am. No one could wish to know it better than a lady of your eminence does.
They would do well, returned Mrs. Sparsit, to take example by you, Bitzer.
Thank you, ma'am. But since you do refer to me, now look at me, ma'am. I have put by a little, ma'am, already. That gratuity which I receive at Christmas, ma'am, I never touch it. I don't even go to the length of my wages, though they're not high, ma'am. Why can't they do as I have done, ma'am? What one person can do, another can do.
This, again, was among the fictions of Coketown. Any capitalist there who had made £60,000 out of sixpence always professed to wonder why the 60,000 nearest hands didn't each make £60,000 out of sixpence, and more or less reproached them every one for not accomplishing the little feat. What I did, you can do. Why don't you go and do it?
As to their wanting recreations, ma'am, said Bitzer, it's stuff and nonsense. I don't want recreations. I never did and I never shall. I don't like 'em. As to their combining together, there are many of them, I have no doubt, that by watching and informing upon one another could earn a trifle now and then, whether in money or goodwill, and improve their livelihood. Then why don't they improve it, ma'am? It's the first consideration of a rational creature, and it's what they pretend to want.
Pretend, indeed, said Mrs. Sparsit.
I'm sure we're constantly hearing, ma'am, till it becomes quite nauseous concerning their wives and families, said Bitzer. Why, look at me, ma'am. I don't want a wife and family. Why should they?
Because they are improvident, said Mrs. Sparsit.
Yes, ma'am, returned Bitzer. That's where it is. If they were more provident and less perverse, ma'am, what would they do? They would say, while my hat covers my family, or while my bonnet covers my family, as the case might be, ma'am, I have only one to feed, and that's the person I most like to feed.
To be sure,
assented Mrs. Sparsit, eating muffin.
Thank you, ma'am, said Bitzer,
knuckling his forehead again in return for the favour of Mrs. Sparsit's improving conversation.
"Would you wish a little more hot water, ma'am, or is there anything else that I could fetch you?"
"Nothing just now, Bitzer."
"Thank you, ma'am. I shouldn't wish to disturb you at your meals, ma'am, particularly tea, knowing your partiality for it," said Bitzer,
craning a little to look over into the street from where he stood.
"But there's a gentleman been looking up here for a minute or so, ma'am, and he has come across as if he was going to knock."
"That is his knock, ma'am, no doubt."
He stepped to the window, and looking out and drawing in his head again, confirmed himself with,
"Yes, ma'am. Would you wish the gentleman to be shown in, ma'am?"
"I don't know who it can be," said Mrs. Sparsit, wiping her mouth and arranging her mittens.
"A stranger, ma'am, evidently."
"What a stranger can want at the bank at this time of evening, unless he comes upon some business for which he is too late? I don't know," said Mrs. Sparsit. "But I hold a charge in this establishment from Mr. Bounderby, and I will never shrink from it. If to see him is any part of the duty I've accepted, I will see him. Use your own discretion, Bitzer."
Here the visitor, all unconscious of Mrs. Sparsit's magnanimous words, repeated his knock so loudly that the light porter hastened down to open the door, while Mrs. Sparsit took the precaution of concealing her little table with all its appliances upon it in a cupboard, and then decamped upstairs that she might appear, if needful, with the greater dignity.
"If you please, ma'am, the gentleman would wish to see you," said Bitzer,
with his light eye at Mrs. Sparsit's keyhole. So Mrs. Sparsit, who had improved the interval by touching up her cap, took her classical features downstairs again, and entered the boardroom in the manner of a Roman matron going outside the city walls to treat with an invading general. The visitor, having strolled to the window and being then engaged in looking carelessly out, was as unmoved by this impressive entry as man could possibly be. He stood whistling to himself with all imaginable coolness, with his hat still on, and a certain air of exhaustion upon him, in part arising from excessive summer, and in part from excessive gentility, for it was to be seen with half an eye that he was a thorough gentleman, made to the model of the time, weary of everything, and putting no more faith in anything than Lucifer.
"I believe, sir," quoth Mrs. Sparsit, "you wish to see me."
"I beg your pardon," he said, turning and removing his hat. "Pray excuse me."
"Hm,"
thought Mrs. Sparsit as she made a stately bend.
35, good looking, good figure, good teeth, good voice, good breeding, well-dressed, dark hair, bold eyes."
All which Mrs. Sparsit observed in her womanly way, like the sultan who put his head in the pail of water, merely in dipping down and coming up again.
"Please to be seated, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit.
"Thank you. Allow me."
He placed a chair for her, but remained himself carelessly lounging against the table.
"I left my servant at the railway, looking after the luggage. Very heavy train, and vast quantity of it in the van, and strolled on looking about me. Exceedingly odd place. Will you allow me to ask you if it's always as black as this?"
"In general, much blacker,"
returned Mrs. Sparsit in her uncompromising way.
"Is it possible?"
"Excuse me, you are not a native, I think."
"No, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit. "It was once my good or ill fortune, as it may be, before I became a widow, to move in a very different sphere. My husband was a Powler."
"Beg your pardon, really," said the stranger. "Was..."
Mrs. Sparsit repeated.
"A Powler."
"Powler family," said the stranger, after reflecting a few moments.
Mrs. Sparsit signified assent. The stranger seemed a little more fatigued than before.
"You must be very much bored here," was the inference he drew from the communication.
"I am the servant of circumstances, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit, "and I have long adapted myself to the governing power of my life."
"Very philosophical," returned the stranger, "and very exemplary and laudable, and..."
It seemed to be scarcely worth his while to finish the sentence, so he played with his watch chain wearily.
"'May I be permitted to ask, sir,' said Mrs. Sparsit, "'to what I am indebted for the favour of... "'Assuredly,' said the stranger, "'much obliged to you for reminding me. "'I am the bearer of a letter of introduction to Mr. Bounderby the banker. "'Walking through this extraordinarily black town, "'while they were getting dinner ready at the hotel, "'I asked a fellow whom I met, one of the working people, "'who appeared to have been taking a shower bath of something fluffy.' "'which I assume to be the raw material,' Mrs. Sparsit inclined her head. "'Raw material. "'Where Mr. Bounderby the banker might reside. "'Upon which, misled no doubt by the word banker, "'he directed me to the bank. "'Fact being, I presume that Mr. Bounderby the banker "'does not reside in the edifice in which I have the honour of offering this explanation.' "'No, sir,' returned Mrs. Sparsit. "'He does not.' Thank you. I had no intention of delivering my letter at the present moment, nor have I, but strolling on to the bank to kill time, and having the good fortune to observe at the window, towards which he languidly waved his hand, then slightly bowed, a lady of a very superior and agreeable appearance, I considered that I could not do better than take the liberty of asking that lady where Mr. Bounderby the banker does live— which I accordingly venture, with all suitable apologies, to do. The inattention and indolence of his manner were sufficiently relieved to Mrs. Sparsit's thinking by a certain gallantry at ease which offered her homage too. Here he was, for instance, at this moment all but sitting on the table, and yet lazily bending over her, as if he acknowledged an attraction in her that made her charming, in her way. "'Banks, I know, are always suspicious, and officially must be,' said the stranger, whose lightness and smoothness of speech were pleasant likewise, suggesting matter far more sensible and humorous than it ever contained, which was perhaps a shrewd device of the founder of this numerous sect, whosoever may have been that great man. "'Therefore I may observe that my letter—here it is—is from the member for this place, Gradgrind.' "'whom I have had the pleasure of knowing in London.' "'Mrs. Sparsit recognised the hand, "'intimated that such confirmation was quite unnecessary, "'and gave Mr. Bounderby's address "'with all needful clues and directions in aid. "'A thousand thanks,' said the stranger. "'Of course you know the banker well.'
"'Yes, sir,' rejoined Mrs. Sparsit. "'In my dependent relation towards him, "'I have known him 10 years.'
"'Quite an eternity. "'I think he married Gradgrind's daughter?'
"'Yes,' said Mrs. Sparsit, suddenly compressing her mouth. "'He had that honour.'
"'The lady is quite a philosopher, I am told.'
"'Indeed, sir,' said Mrs. Sparsit. "'Is she?'
"'Excuse my impertinent curiosity,' pursued the stranger, "'fluttering over Mrs. Sparsit's eyebrows with a propitiatory air.' "'But you know the family, and know the world. "'I am about to know the family, and may have much to do with them. "'Is the lady so very alarming? "'Her father gives her such a portentously hard-headed reputation "'that I have a burning desire to know. "'Is she absolutely unapproachable, repellently and stunningly clever? "'I see by your meaning smile you think not. "'You have poured balm into my anxious soul.' "'As to age now, 40? 35? "'Mrs. Sparsit laughed outright.
"'A chit,' said she, "'not 20 when she was married.'
"'I give you my honour, Mrs. Powler,' returned the stranger, "'detaching himself from the table, "'that I never was so astonished in all my life. "'It really did seem to impress him, "'to the utmost extent of his capacity for being impressed.' He looked at his informant for full quarter of a minute, and appeared to have the surprise in his mind all the time. "'I assure you, Mrs. Powler,' he then said, much exhausted, "'that the father's manner prepared me for a grim and stony maturity. "'I am obliged to you, of all things, for correcting so absurd a mistake. "'Pray excuse my intrusion. Many thanks. Good day.'
He bowed himself out, and Mrs. Sparsit, hiding in the window curtain, saw him languishing down the street on the shady side of the way, observed of all the town.
"What do you think of the gentleman, Bitzer?" she asked the light porter when he came to take away.
"Spends a deal of money on his dress, ma'am."
"It must be admitted," said Mrs. Sparsit, "that it's very tasteful."
"Yes, ma'am," returned Bitzer, "if that's worth the money." "Besides which, ma'am," resumed Bitzer while he was polishing the table, "he looks to me as if he gamed."
"It's immoral to game," said Mrs. Sparsit.
"It's ridiculous, ma'am," said Bitzer, "because the chances are against the players."
Whether it was that the heat prevented Mrs. Sparsit from working, or whether it was that her hand was out, she did no work that night. She sat at the window when the sun began to sink behind the smoke. She sat there when the smoke was burning red, when the colour faded from it, when darkness seemed to rise slowly out of the ground and creep upward, upward, up to the housetops, up the church steeple, up to the summits of the factory chimneys, up to the sky. Without a candle in the room, Mrs. Sparsit sat at the window with her hands before her, not thinking much of the sounds of evening, the whooping of boys, the barking of dogs, the rumbling of wheels, the steps and voices of passengers, the shrill street cries, the clogs upon the pavement when it was their hour for going by, the shutting up of shop shutters. Not until the light porter announced that her nocturnal sweetbread was ready did Mrs. Sparsit arouse herself from her reverie and convey her dense black eyebrows, by that time creased with meditation as if they needed ironing out, upstairs.
"Oh, you fool," said Mrs. Sparsit when she was alone at her supper. Whom she meant, she did not say,
but she could scarcely have meant the sweetbread.
Chapter 2. Mr. James Harthouse. The Gradgrind party wanted assistance in cutting the throats of the Graces. They went about recruiting, and where could they enlist recruits more hopefully than among the fine gentlemen who, having found out everything to be worth nothing, were equally ready for anything? Moreover, the healthy spirits who had mounted to this sublime height were attractive to many of the Gradgrind school. They liked fine gentlemen. They pretended that they did not, but they did. They became exhausted in imitation of them, and they yaw-yawed in their speech like them, and they served out with an enervated air the little mouldy rations of political economy on which they regaled their disciples. There never before was seen on earth such a wonderful hybrid race as was thus produced. Among the fine gentlemen not regularly belonging to the Gradgrind school, there was one of a good family and a better appearance, with a happy turn of humour which had told immensely with the House of Commons on the occasion of his entertaining it with his and the Board of Directors' view of a railway accident, in which the most careful officers ever known, employed by the most liberal managers ever heard of, assisted by the finest mechanical contrivances ever devised, the whole in action on the best line ever constructed, had killed 5 people and wounded 32, by a casualty without which the excellence of the whole system would have been positively incomplete. Among the slain was a cow, and among the scattered articles unowned, a widow's cap, and the honourable member had so tickled the house, which has a delicate sense of humour, by putting the cap on the cow, that it became impatient of any serious reference to the coroner's inquest, and brought the railway off with cheers and laughter. Now, this gentleman had a younger brother of still better appearance than himself, who had tried life as a cornet of dragoons, and found it a bore, and had afterwards tried it in the train of an English minister abroad, and found it a bore, and had then strolled to Jerusalem and got bored there, and then gone yachting about the world and got bored everywhere. To whom this honourable and jocular member fraternally said one day, "Jim, there's a good opening among the hard fact fellows, and they want men. I wonder you don't go in for statistics." Jim, rather taken by the novelty of the idea, and very hard up for a change, was as ready to go in for statistics as for anything else. So he went in. He coached himself up with a blue book or two,
and his brother put it about among the hard fact fellows and said, "If you want to bring in for any place a handsome dog who can make you a devilish good speech, look after my brother Jem, for he's your man." After a few dashes in the public meeting way, Mr. Gradgrind and a council of political sages approved of Jem, and it was resolved to send him down to Coketown to become known there and in the neighbourhood. Hence the letter Jem had last night shown to Mrs. Sparsit, which Mr. Bounderby now held in his hand, superscribed, "Josiah Bounderby, Esquire, Banker, Coketown, specially to introduce James Harthouse, Esquire, Thomas Gradgrind." Within an hour of the receipt of this dispatch and Mr. James Harthouse's card, Mr. Bounderby put on his hat and went down to the hotel. There he found Mr. James Harthouse looking out of the window in a state of mind so disconsolate that he was already half-disposed to go in for something else.
"My name, sir," said his visitor, "is Josiah Bounderby of Coketown."
Mr. James Harthouse was very happy indeed, though he scarcely looked so, to have a pleasure he had long expected.
"Coketown, sir," said Bounderby, obstinately taking a chair, "is not the kind of place you have been accustomed to. Therefore, if you will allow me, or whether you will or not, for I am a plain man, I'll tell you something about it before we go any further."
Mr. Harthouse would be charmed.
"Don't be too sure of that," said Bounderby. "I don't promise it. First of all, you see our smoke. That's meat and drink to us. It's the healthiest thing in the world in all respects, and particularly for the lungs. If you are one of those who want us to consume it, I differ from you. We are not going to wear the bottoms of our boilers out any faster than we wear them out now, for all the humbugging sentiment in Great Britain and Ireland."
By way of going in to the fullest extent, Mr. Harthouse rejoined, "Mr. Bounderby, I assure you I am entirely and completely of your way of thinking, on conviction."
"I am glad to hear it," said Bounderby. "Now, you have heard a lot of talk about the work in our mills, no doubt. You have? Very good. I'll state the fact of it to you. It's the pleasantest work there is, and it's the lightest work there is, and it's the best paid work there is. More than that, we couldn't improve the mills themselves unless we laid down Turkey carpets on the floors, which we're not going to do."
"Mr. Bounderby, perfectly right."
"Lastly," said Bounderby, "as to our hands. There's not a hand in this town, sir, man, woman, or child, but has one ultimate object in life. That object is to be fed on turtle soup and venison with a gold spoon. Now, they're not a-going, none of them, ever, to be fed on turtle soup and venison with a gold spoon. And now you know the place."
Mr. Harthouse professed himself in the highest degree instructed and refreshed by this condensed epitome of the whole Coketown question.
"Why, you see," replied Mr. Bounderby, "it suits my disposition to have a full understanding with a man, particularly with a public man, when I make his acquaintance. I have only one thing more to say to you, Mr. Harthouse, before assuring you of the pleasure with which I shall respond, to the utmost of my poor ability, to my friend Tom Gradgrind's letter of introduction. You are a man of family. Don't you deceive yourself by supposing for a moment that I am a man of family. I am a bit of dirty riff-raff and a genuine scrap of tag-rag and bobtail."
If anything could have exalted Jem's interest in Mr. Bounderby, it would have been this very circumstance, or so he told him.
"So now," said Bounderby, "we may shake hands on equal terms. I say equal terms because although I know what I am, and the exact depth of the gutter I have lifted myself out of, better than any man does, I am as proud as you are. I am just as proud as you are. Having now asserted my independence in a proper manner, I may come to how do you find yourself, and I hope you're pretty well."
The better Mr. Harthouse gave him to understand as they shook hands, for the salubrious air of Coketown. Mr. Bounderby received the answer with favour.
"Perhaps you know," said he, "or perhaps you don't know. I married Tom Gradgrind's daughter. If you have nothing better to do than walk up town with me, I shall be glad to introduce you to Tom Gradgrind's daughter."
"Mr. Bounderby," said Jem, "you anticipate my dearest wishes." They went out without further discourse, and Mr. Bounderby piloted the new acquaintance who so strongly contrasted with him
to the private red brick dwelling with the black outside shutters, the green inside blinds, and the black street door up two white steps. In the drawing room of which mansion, there presently entered to them the most remarkable girl Mr. James Harthouse had ever seen. She was so constrained and yet so careless, so reserved and yet so watchful, so cold and proud and yet so sensitively ashamed of her husband's braggart humility, from which she shrunk as if every example of it were a cut or a blow, that it was quite a new sensation to observe her. In face she was no less remarkable than in manner. Her features were handsome, but their natural play was so locked up that it seemed impossible to guess at their genuine expression. Utterly indifferent, perfectly self-reliant, never at a loss, and yet never at her ease with her figure in company with them there, and her mind apparently quite alone, it was of no use going in yet a while to comprehend this girl, for she baffled all penetration. From the mistress of the house, the visitor glanced to the house itself. There was no mute sign of a woman in the room, no graceful little adornment, no fanciful little device, however trivial, anywhere expressed her influence. Cheerless and comfortless, boastfully and doggedly rich, there the room stared at its present occupants, unsoftened and unrelieved by the least trace of any womanly occupation. As Mr. Bounderby stood in the midst of his household gods, so those unrelenting divinities occupied their places around Mr. Bounderby, and they were worthy of one another, and well matched. "This, sir," said Bounderby, "is my wife, Mrs. Bounderby, Tom Gradgrind's eldest daughter, Lou. Mr. James Harthouse. Mr. Harthouse has joined your father's muster roll. If he is not Tom Gradgrind's colleague before long, I believe we shall at least hear of him in connection with one of our neighbouring towns. You observe, Mr. Harthouse, that my wife is my junior. I don't know what she saw in me to marry me, but she saw something in me, I suppose, or she wouldn't have married me. She has lots of expensive knowledge, sir, political and otherwise. If you want to cram for anything, I should be troubled to recommend you to a better adviser than Lou Bounderby." To a more agreeable adviser, or one from whom he would be more likely to learn, Mr. Harthouse could never be recommended. "Come," said his host. "If you're in the complimentary line, you'll get on here, for you'll meet with no competition. I have never been in the way of learning compliments myself, and I don't profess to understand the art of paying them. In fact, despise them. But your bringing up was different from mine. Mine was a real thing, by George. You are a gentleman, and I don't pretend to be one. I am Josiah Bounderby of Coketown, and that's enough for me. However, though I am not influenced by manners and station, Lou Bounderby may be. She hadn't my advantages, disadvantages, you would call them, but I call them advantages, so you'll not waste your power, I dare say." "Mr. Bounderby," said Jem, turning with a smile to Louisa, "is a noble animal in a comparatively natural state, quite free from the harness in which a conventional hack like myself works." "You respect Mr. Bounderby very much," she quietly returned. "It is natural that you should. He was disgracefully thrown out for a gentleman who had seen so much of the world, and thought, 'Now, how am I to take this?' You are going to devote yourself, as I gather from what Mr. Bounderby has said, to the service of your country. You have made up your mind," said Louisa, still standing before him where she had first stopped, in all the singular contrariety of her self-possession and her being obviously very ill at ease, "to show the nation the way out of all its difficulties." "Mrs. Bounderby," he returned, laughing, "upon my honour, no. I will make no such pretence to you. I have seen a little here and there, up and down. I have found it all to be very worthless, as everybody has, and as some confess they have, and some do not. And I am going in for your respected father's opinions, really because I have no choice of opinions, and may as well back them as anything else." "Have you none of your own?" asked Louisa. "I have not so much as the slightest predilection left. I assure you I attach not the least importance to any opinions. The result of the varieties of boredom I have undergone
is a conviction, unless conviction is too industrious a word for the lazy sentiment I entertain on the subject, that any set of ideas will do just as much good as any other set and just as much harm as any other set. There's an English family with a charming Italian motto, "What will be, will be." It's the only truth going. This vicious assumption of honesty in dishonesty, a vice so dangerous, so deadly, and so common, seemed, he observed, a little to impress her in his favour. He followed up the advantage by saying in his pleasantest manner, a manner to which she might attach as much or as little meaning as she pleased, "The side that can prove anything in a line of units, tens, hundreds, and thousands, Mrs. Bounderby, seems to me to afford the most fun and to give a man the best chance. I'm quite as much attached to it as if I believed it. I'm quite ready to go in for it to the same extent as if I believed it. And what more could I possibly do if I did believe it?" "You are a singular politician," said Louisa. "Pardon me, I have not even that merit. We are the largest party in the state, I assure you, Mrs. Bounderby, if we all fell out of our adopted ranks and were reviewed together." Mr. Bounderby, who had been in danger of bursting in silence, interposed here with a project for postponing the family dinner till 6:30, and taking Mr. James Harthouse in the meantime on a round of visits to the voting and interesting notabilities of Coketown and its vicinity. The round of visits was made, and Mr. James Harthouse, with a discreet use of his blue coaching, came off triumphantly, though with a considerable accession of boredom. In the evening, he found the dinner table laid for four, but they sat down only three. It was an appropriate occasion for Mr. Bounderby to discuss the flavour of the halfpennyworth of stewed eels he had purchased in the streets at 8 years old, and also of the inferior water, specially used for laying the dust, with which he had washed down that repast. He likewise entertained his guest over the soup and fish with the calculation that he, Bounderby, had eaten in his youth at least three horses under the guise of Polonies and Saveloys. These recitals Jem, in a languid manner, received with charming every now and then, and they probably would have decided him to go in for Jerusalem again tomorrow morning had he been less curious respecting Louisa. "Is there nothing," he thought, glancing at her as she sat at the head of the table, where her youthful figure, small and slight but very graceful, looked as pretty as it looked misplaced. "Is there nothing that will move that face?" Yes, by Jupiter, there was something, and here it was, in an unexpected shape. Tom appeared. She changed as the door opened and broke into a beaming smile. A beautiful smile. Mr. James Harthouse might not have thought so much of it, but that he had wondered so long at her impassive face. She put out her hand, a pretty little soft hand, and her fingers closed upon her brother's as if she would have carried them to her lips. "Aye, aye," thought the visitor. "This whelp is the only creature she cares for." So. The whelp was presented and took his chair. The appellation was not flattering, but not unmerited. "When I was your age, young Tom," said Bounderby, "I was punctual or I got no dinner." "When you were my age," resumed Tom, "you hadn't a wrong balance to get right and hadn't to dress afterwards." "Never mind that now," said Bounderby. "Well then," grumbled Tom, "don't begin with me." "Mrs. Bounderby," said Harthouse, perfectly hearing this understrain as it went on, "your brother's face is quite familiar to me. Can I have seen him abroad, or at some public school, perhaps?" "No," she resumed, quite interested. "He has never been abroad yet, and was educated here at home. Tom, love, I'm telling Mr. Harthouse that he never saw you abroad."
"No such luck, sir," said Tom.
There was little enough in him to brighten her face, for he was a sullen young fellow, and ungracious in his manner even to her. So much the greater must have been the solitude of her heart and her need of someone on whom to bestow it. So much the more is this whelp the only creature she has ever cared for,
thought Mr. James Harthouse, turning it over and over.
So much the more. So much the more.
Both in his sister's presence and after she had left the room, the whelp took no pains to hide his contempt for Mr. Bounderby, whenever he could indulge it without the observation of that independent man, by making wry faces or shutting one eye. Without responding to these telegraphic communications, Mr. Harthouse encouraged him much in the course of the evening, and showed an unusual liking for him. At last, when he rose to return to his hotel and was a little doubtful whether he knew the way by night, the whelp immediately proffered his services as guide, and turned out with him to escort him thither. Chapter 3. The Whelp. It was very remarkable that a young gentleman who had been brought up under one continuous system of unnatural restraint should be a hypocrite, but it was certainly the case with Tom. It was very strange that a young gentleman who had never been left to his own guidance for 5 consecutive minutes should be incapable at last of governing himself. But so it was with Tom. It was altogether unaccountable that a young gentleman whose imagination had been strangled in his cradle should be still inconvenienced by its ghost in the form of grovelling sensualities. But such a monster, beyond all doubt, was Tom.
"Do you smoke?" asked Mr. James Harthouse when they came to the hotel.
"I believe you do," said Tom. He could do no less than ask Tom up, and Tom could do no less than go up. What with a cooling drink adapted to the weather, but not so weak as cool, and what with rarer tobacco than was to be bought in those parts, Tom was soon in a highly free and easy state at his end of the sofa, and more than ever disposed to admire his new friend at the other end. Tom blew his smoke aside, after he had been smoking a little while, and took an observation of his friend.
"He don't seem to care about his dress," thought Tom, "and yet how capitally he does it. What an easy swell he is."
Mr. James Harthouse, happening to catch Tom's eye, remarked that he drank nothing, and filled his glass with his own negligent hand.
"Thank ye," said Tom, "thank ye.
Well, Mr. Harthouse, I hope you have had about a dose of old Bounderby tonight." Tom said this with one eye shut up again, and looking over his glass knowingly at his entertainer.
"A very good fellow indeed," returned Mr. James Harthouse.
"You think so, don't you?" said Tom, and shut up his eye again. Mr. James Harthouse smiled, and rising from his end of the sofa and lounging with his back against the chimney-piece, so that he stood before the empty fire grate as he smoked, in front of Tom and looking down at him, observed,
"What a comical brother-in-law you are."
"What a comical brother-in-law old Bounderby is, I think you mean," said Tom.
"You are a piece of caustic, Tom," retorted Mr. James Harthouse.
For something so very agreeable in being so intimate with such a waistcoat, in being called Tom in such an intimate way by such a voice, in being on such off-hand terms so soon with such a pair of whiskers, that Tom was uncommonly pleased with himself.
"Oh, I don't care for old Bounderby," said he, "if you mean that. I've always called old Bounderby by the same name when I've talked about him, and I've always thought of him in the same way. I'm not going to begin to be polite now about old Bounderby. It would be rather late in the day."
"Don't mind me," returned James, "but take care when his wife is by, you know."
"His wife?" said Tom. "My sister, Lou?"
"Oh, yes." And he laughed and took a little more of the cooling drink. James Harthouse continued to lounge in the same place and attitude, smoking his cigar in his own easy way, and looking pleasantly at the whelp, as if he knew himself to be a kind of agreeable demon who had only to hover over him and he must give up his whole soul if required. It certainly did seem that the whelp yielded to this influence. He looked at his companion sneakingly, he looked at him admiringly, he looked at him boldly, and put one leg up on the sofa.
"My sister Lou," said Tom,
She never cared for old Bounderby.
That's the past tense, Tom, returned Mr. James Harthouse, striking the ash from his cigar with his little finger. We are in the present tense now.
Verb neuter, not to care. Indicative mood, present tense. First person singular, I do not care. Second person singular, that.